The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Good morning to all of you. I've gotten a chance to say, it's a small enough group, I've gotten a chance to meet all of you, maybe most of you, I think, so far. Welcome to our session on the challenges of classical education in university model type schools. And it's kind of a long university model type school, and we'll explain why we call it that. If we haven't had a chance to meet, my name is Bill Rector, and I'm the headmaster of Coram Deo Academy. We have three campuses in the Dallas area. We have 1,275 students this fall spread out over those three campuses, and I'm in charge of all three, and we have principals at each one. We are a rare distinction, as many of you are as well, and that is we're a classical Christian school, and we're a university model school. So I want to try and explain, in 17 years that I've been at Coram Deo Academy, some of what we've seen of the great benefits to that, and also some of the challenges that maybe you have, and I firmly believe we'll have time at the end of this for questions and comments. So if you would indulge me, let me begin in a word of prayer. Father, thank you so much for the task you've given us of educating young minds. We thank you for this conference, this opportunity for us to share ideas with one another. We give you thanks and praise for this time. We ask you to redeem it. We ask you to be our teacher and to use the conversation to better our service to you. We devote this time to you in Christ's name. Amen. Well, I think it is important to say that we are firmly at Coram Deo. We firmly believe in classical Christian education. But in addition to that, there's a fundamental principle that God has woven into the universe, and that is that parents are the primary educators of their children. And when I say this to people, I have to be careful now because it sounds like it's an admonition. It sounds like I might be saying parents should be the primary educators. And I'm always careful to remind them, and I hope I'm not too heavy-handed about it, but no, it's not that you should be. You are the primary educators of your children, whether you know that you are or not. This is a fundamental welcome. This is a fundamental principle like gravity. And you ignore it at your peril. If I were to step off this building, I would fall whether I believe I'm going to fall or not. And this is the case. Parents are the primary educators of their children. I have a story that recently that illustrated this to me in what I hope you'll find to be a humorous way. And my son graduated from Coram Deo this year. He's 18 and he's really tall and I'm very proud of him. And I took him over Christmas, he had just turned 18, and I took him to a men's breakfast at our church, and I got to introduce him to a lot of the men at our church, and I was so proud of him. And I watched as he did this, and I was he went up and he extended his hand, he looked people right in the eye, and he said his name, "Hi, I'm Kirby Rector." And I said to him, I was so impressed with this, I said to him afterwards, I said, "Son, where did you learn to meet people like that? It was really impressive." And he said to me, he said, "Well, I've just been watching you, Dad, my whole life." And my heart just melted. Isn't that? That's one of those awe moments. But God is a God of humility. And within 2 days of that, we were driving to fix the headlight in his car. You're laughing already. You're not supposed to be laughing already. Some of you know the intrinsic truth I'm about to tell you. And as we're driving, I'm going to show him how to replace his own headlight. He'll save a lot of money. I'm riding in his car. And, you know, we're in the Dallas metro area, and there were some less than courteous drivers, and he had some choice names for them. I'll tell you, they were not profane, but they were not kind at all. And so I asked him, I said, "Where did you learn to talk like that? Do you realize that's the same question?" And I'm afraid I got the same answer. "I've just been watching you, Dad, my whole life." And I'm glad you're laughing at that because I have but to laugh, and it is a reminder that we are, right? The way our children treat people in restaurants, the way they comfort friends in need, the way they talk to drivers on the road, the way they shake hands with people. These are all things that parents are responsible for. And even though My children might be inspired by the literature teacher that introduces them to something that they might not otherwise have had. Now, 90%+ of what they are is molded by the close family. So this is why we are striving to involve parents in the education. We believe that parents are the primary. I think the Bible reinforces that multiple times, Old and New Testament. But I also believe in Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4 says that some are gifted as teachers. You know, before I became the headmaster of this conglomerate in Dallas, I was a math teacher. And I loved teaching the quadratic formula. I know that makes me one of the biggest nerds on earth, but I absolutely just loved doing that. And so to me, I was always hoping that there would be some kind of partnership we could enter into. Give me your 16-year-old child, and let me see if I could introduce them to the wonder and beauty and philosophy of math, right? Through the quadratic formula. I used to tell them, theology begins with the quadratic formula. It's the first time we're able to prove numerically that there is a world of things that are seen and unseen. We've been confessing it our whole life, and now I can prove it to you on the board. Isn't that wonderful? I'd love to do it. I think teachers are gifted by God. I think Ephesians 4 says that. So I don't expect parents who are the primary educators of their child to necessarily be always gifted, according to Ephesians 4. That's why homeschooling is a wonderful thing, but it almost always reaches a point where parents seek out somebody that is gifted, that can inspire their child, and they leverage the community, the body of Christ, to try and do that. And so the university model type school is an attempt to merge that. I know that that's what the founders of Coram Deo Academy wanted. 17 years ago, I guess 18 this fall, they wanted the best of both worlds. And the schedule goes like this, in case you don't know it. For us at Coram Deo, we have a group of students that are with us on Monday, hopefully with a gifted Ephesians 4 teacher. And then there's a lesson that they're given at home on Tuesday. They come back to us on Thursday, and then there's a lesson that they're given for home on Thursday. And that is what this university schedule works like. Now, for us, we also have Friday for some people call them enrichment classes. For us, it's arts and athletics. And that Friday class, that third day a week, is required for our high schools in order to get the necessary laboratory science and the electives that we think are necessary for a complete rhetoric school. Does that make sense? So we actually have two completely different sets of students that attend on Monday and Wednesday and Tuesday and Thursday, and they're merged a little bit on Friday. That's the university model schedule. At the younger grades, some of you know this already, and I know you're from schools that do this, so forgive me. Others of you are, well, how do we do this? At the younger grade, it works best for us to teach the parents to repeat a lesson. If in kindergarten we're going to introduce the letter A, then we can give all the parents all the same materials to repeat that lesson. That tends to work best. So in the younger grades, we're repeating to reinforce the lesson. As they get older, the parents are overseeing the homework, some of the tedious work. You know, we'll assign two chapters of reading so that we can use the class time for discussion. Well, it's the parents' job to make sure they do the reading. And you can imagine this gets a little bit harder as the kids get older. Or at least I should say the role changes more. You become more of a manager, a coach, a consultant as your child gets older. But I think that's consistent with the relationship you have with your child throughout life anyway. And so sometimes this presses on that a little bit. So one of the things that I do want to explain is that this idea actually is trademarked. The reason that this session is called University Model Type School is because it's actually a trademarked phrase, University Model Schools. That trademark is held by an organization called the University Model Schools International, UMSI. You probably know that organization. It changed its name recently as the name NAMS, the National Association of University Model Schools. They changed because it's no longer national. Hundreds of schools now out of the border now of the United States. But you know, one of the first things I thought is, well, look, anybody could implement this schedule. Why do we trademark the term? And I, as a member of University Model Schools International, I'll try and explain it to you. But their website, and I know Barbara Freeman, the director, would actually be glad to explain it to you as well. But there are three main reasons. You know, first of all, to make sure there's a philosophical linkage. If you call yourself a university model school, you must be a Christian school. Because a Buddhist school could put this schedule together. And there's nothing wrong with that. They might want to leverage the involvement of parents as well. But to call yourself a university model school, there's actually, you'll see that circle R. It's a trademarked expression. And that is required that you be a Christian school. So there's a philosophical alignment that trademark was put there for. The other is for quality control. Just because you've implemented that schedule doesn't mean you have the same passion for making, including parents in that. So in order to do that as a member of that organization, we are have certification visits where they come and they check and they make sure that we're doing this to the same standard of quality. It's almost like a form of accreditation. And then finally, the reason that they do this is that it gravitates towards a community. In the same way that all of us are here because we're interested in classical Christian education, you know, there's a community about this. As we discuss these ideas, the iron sharpens the iron, and we learn a lot about how do you teach this in a university model setting from other university model schools. So you might have heard that. You might have wondered, why did they trademark it? But the primary reason, I will tell you, is philosophical. It is to make sure that if a parent is looking for a university model school, they know that it is one that has a Christian background to it. Okay, you could probably right now just stop and think, and if we ended this, you could probably take a paper and divide it in half and come up with some of the advantages and some of the disadvantages that are obvious to this method. So some of these things are things you will have already thought of, but I want to point out a few that we've seen in 17 years, and I think the most obvious is the immense degree of parental involvement. Parental involvement in education is one of the highest corollaries to success in any school. Even the Buddhist school, the secular schools, they will tell you that the more involved the parents are in the education, the higher degree of reward. And so when you're actually teaching the lesson every other day, you're involved. It's more involved than sometimes you'd like to be as a parent. And I know because I have three kids that have come through this model. But the parents are very involved, and that is obvious. The results we get from when that works well are phenomenal. Just imagine what that would be like if these wonderful kindergarten teachers that we all have, and I don't know where God creates them, but they just keep coming out at us. They're wonderfully loving people, and they teach the kindergarten students, and then all of a sudden, then mom or dad reinforces that lesson at home. You know, for a five-year-old, could, other than a uniformed police officer teaching them that lesson, there's just no greater authority that we can instruct them with, right? And so there's an obvious advantage to that. There might be some other advantages that you haven't thought of. I'll detail a few, and then some of you will be able to tell us this at the end of our session here. One of them is something that we call flipping the classroom. I call it that because Saul Kahn has made that term in the Khan Academy. Part of his goal was to say, look, watch the video where I'll teach the mundane algebra, and then you get to the classroom and the teacher can work on the problems, the difficult part of it. And so instead of the classroom being where they're bored and learning the mundane things, the classroom is where we learn the most interesting things. We flip the classroom. In a university model school, you're forced to do that. But that's very positive. Our students read and do a lot of their I don't want to say mundane, but a lot of the groundwork of their learning at home. And then they come to class, and the class is where we try to make it the most interesting part of the discussion. We try and focus on the most difficult problems, and that's part of that. So we flipped the classroom there. Another thing about this that maybe is the, you will get immediately, but maybe you didn't think of, is how well prepared these students are for a collegiate environment. One of the things that we have almost 500 alumni now, and they tell us routinely that they're so prepared. Their roommates are up till 2 and 3 in the morning because they don't know how to operate on this schedule. He says, and we've been doing it since we were kindergarten. So it is indeed a college prep atmosphere, given that that's one of the reasons they call it the university schedule. I guess I hit on one earlier, and that is that the lessons are repeated. You know, that's multiple reinforcement by a parent at home. Through the early grades, you're taught one thing, you're taught it again. And that repetition is very comforting, especially at the grammar stage of learning. It's a personal belief there, but I think that's a hallmark of classical education. The repetition that we go through is something that the parents help us with. So the parents learn all the same jingles. They learn the Shirley Gramble. There's not a parent in our school that couldn't tell you a sentence, sentence, sentence is complete, complete, complete. Every one of them can do that. They're sick of it. They hate me for it. But in the end, they get to a point where they realize, oh, that was part of the learning. And that's how that works. Another thing that is really a very helpful thing that we're only now beginning to leverage at our school, because we're understanding that one of the ways to observe some of the intangible things about your school can best be done by parents. And let me give you an example of something. One of the hallmarks that we're really starting to stress now is the love of learning. If you want to inculcate this love of learning in students, and one of the things that we tell people is this is a hallmark of classical education. If you give a man a fish, he eats for the day. If you teach him to fish, he eats for a lifetime. And you've probably heard that. But if you can inspire a love of fishing in somebody, then they feed the whole village for a lifetime with joy. Right? And so that's the power of that. How do you know if you're succeeding at inspiring a love of learning in your children? I mean, how do you measure that? I'm an engineer at heart. If something is measurable, I used to think it was not valuable. Right? I have to be able to measure. I need some kind of Christometer to know how we're doing on discipleship. I need something to know. How are we doing at inspiring the love of learning? Well, I don't think there'll be a metric. But David Hicks actually told me when I asked him this question, he says, it's simple. Of course, that's David. It makes everything simple. Observe them when they're not in school. Watch what they're doing when they're not required to learn. Will they still grab a Lego set and build something? The heart of the explorer being cultivated. Will they watch different shows? Will they watch Nova instead of fill in whatever trash of the day that you want, right? Will they go outside and explore when given a chance? Will they actually pick up a book and read? Maybe you might not have chosen the book, but there's a love of learning. And who is in the best driver's seat to observe that? Parents. And as we teach them to do that, parents are also in the best place to exemplify that. And the love of learning might not always look like a dusty book. It might look like doing some of those same things, right? Let's cook something new that's a little bit experimental. And you can see the similarity to a chemistry recipe. So this is part of involving the parents and observing outside the classroom, we know when we're succeeding at that love of learning. And as we started doing that, we realized we have a long way to go with that, but it is, I believe, the best place to do that. Whether you're a university model school or not, your parents are the best source of information regarding that. You may not have thought of it, but there's an advantage administratively. There's a couple of advantages. One is your teachers get really good at teaching their subject quickly because they teach it twice as many lessons. Okay? In our school, we have two sections of algebra on Monday and two sections on Tuesday. So when I teach an algebra lesson, I teach it four times a year. You get pretty good at teaching it. It's a little bit like in your drama departments, you've probably already figured out, if you haven't, that the more performances the students give, even little ones, you know, to just perform at a local school, perform to the younger kids, that the more times they do that, the more they get better at it. Your teachers are no different. Practicing the same lesson four times actually makes you a better teacher faster than if you just do it once and you wait a year again to go, you know, I wish I could do this differently. So there's an economy to that that we've noticed. Our teachers, if they're not already good at this, they get good very quickly by repeating these lessons and immediately incorporating things that work. This also helps us with an ability to employ part-time. Coram Deo is big by most standards, 1,275 students, but we still have mostly part-time employees, and so do probably most of you. And we got to try and find out, how do we fit this? How do we piece this together? I was attracted to the school because I had a consulting job that met on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and I was actually unemployed looking for something to do on Tuesday and Thursday. So when I called the founder of our school and he says, well, you know, listen, I've got a math position open, but it's only Tuesday and Thursday. Immediately, it was a God thing, right, for me. But that helps us. Some of the best source of teachers for us are parents that want to be home with their kids on Tuesday and Thursday, but they don't mind coming with them to the school and teaching something that they're a specialist in or that they've been gifted in on Monday and Wednesday. That allows us that ability to employ part-time. And that really is helpful when you know you can't always have everyone full-time at your school. Another thing that you probably have figured out, if not, and that is the economy of the use of space, right? Our largest campus is our Flower Mound campus, where our home office is, and that's where you'll find me most of the time. We will have approximately 700 students attending that campus, but no more than 375 on any given day. So a facility that houses 400 students allows us to have 700 students going to that because of the use of space. So it improves the economy of the use of the space. It also, depending upon how you structure your tuition, you can pass some of that savings on to your parents. University model schools are typically, I don't want to speak for all of you here, but they're typically priced a little bit lower because at least 2 days of supervision are being provided by the parents. So those are the advantages. Some of you might immediately be wanting to raise your hand and shout out a few more, but I think it would be important for me to also, before we go on, to talk about some of the obvious limitations, because I'm sure there are people going, yeah, but what about? You didn't mention this, and I'm going to. And many of them are the same issue, right? Sun Tzu says in The Art of War that an army's greatest strength will also be their greatest weakness. Right? And I think that's probably true in a lot of organizations. So for university model schools, some of these things that were our greatest strength is also that greatest weakness. We flipped the classroom by making that time very valuable and very interesting, but that's reduced seat time as well. For some subjects, that works okay. If we want to assign 2 hours of reading from Dante and then focus on a really great 55-minute discussion, we do that. But wouldn't it be great if we got to have two discussions instead of one? And so there are 64 only class days that you have in a year. And that's a problem. 64 lessons. You get to do them over and over again, so you practice that and you get good. But there's no textbooks that are divided into just 64 lessons. Matter of fact, right now what you see in a lot of modern textbooks is everybody, you got everything in it. It's like stone soup, if you remember that fable. You know, hundreds of lessons. And so we have to be good editors of the texts and the other sources of information that we use. Which lessons do we choose? That reduced seat time is one of the biggest challenges. Nothing is off the rack for us when it comes to curriculum. We have to cut it and slice it and work together with our faculty to figure out, okay, we're going to probably do these two lessons together because they emphasize the same thing. And then if you've been in a university model school, you know that. There's less time for what I'll call classroom leisure activities. And those things might not be appealing to you, but I actually think that sometimes through leisure we actually learn. There are times when we just want to go out and think about why the sky is blue and lay up on the grass and look up at it. And when you're pressed for 64 class days, you really don't have time for instructor-led activities. We encourage the parents to do that, and the ones that are really into this do, and they get great results. But there are times when we would just like to be able to slow down and, okay, contemplate what we just said for a minute. Let's have 5 minutes of silence. Write down the first five observations you get. And, you know, teachers are able to employ that, but obviously not as often as we'd like. The same is true with the Socratic dialogue. A good 55-minute Socratic dialogue is okay regarding the attention span of our students. But we'd love to start one on Monday, continue it on Tuesday, and then and then keep that going through the week. And that's more difficult in the university model. Another thing, and I told you that one of the great strengths is I'm able to have twice the number of students in a facility. Well, but it's still the same number of accounts. You know, we still have 1,275 accounting statements that we need to have. We still have to have 1,275 billings, 1,275 grades, 1,275 assignments that are going back and forth. So you don't get all the savings there. Administratively, you have to take care of a larger number of accounts. Then you have full-time equivalent revenue coming in. And that's a reality. But in the end, I personally think that it's that's a trade-off that's worth doing. One of the hardest things that there's just no way around it. It hurts us every year to watch is that struggling students, ones that need help in a particular subject, there really isn't time for the teacher to spend with them. I see this in math, that there were, you know, at least one or two students every year that would fall behind, and the best thing I could do was get with the parents and try to arrange some kind of a tutorial, and that was just the best we could offer. We really couldn't slow down the class to take time for that because the schedule didn't allow. And because of that, and I don't just mean struggling students, I mean sometimes those that are having learning disabilities, I really struggle with this because I think this is an important response for us to the community is to start understanding that whether it's the devices or whether it's the SpongeBob assault on their attention span, we're going to be dealing with ADHD, and a university model school is less equipped to do that, where a five-day-a-week school can. Some of you are saying, well, we're less equipped to deal with it too, and I understand that, but it's really when they're only there 2 days a week, it's really hard. I think that the struggling students is, if there are any of us that are committed to this that would say that that's the hardest thing about it, it's that. It's in this model, the teachers that I talk to are just, they have a huge burden for the one lost sheep that's falling behind, and the best thing we could do is get them into another fold, and that's hard. Obviously, this model requires that a parent be home with the student. Not every family can do that. That's an economic reality. Some are blessed by God to be able to do that. Not every family is. And that happens over a period. We see families that start with us in kindergarten. They are with us for several years, and then something happens economically where in order to stay in the community that they love, dad might take a lesser job, mom has to go back to work, and they might try it for a year, but it ultimately falls down. And this is very difficult. It's hard for me to offer a model to people that they not everyone economically can do. And we did have one parent that asked if she could hire a nanny to do the Coram Deo part of the assessment. And you might think, well, that would work. I mean, well, no, if parents are the primary educators of the child, then what you're teaching your daughter is how to hire someone to maintain your primary responsibility. And that didn't end well with that interview with that family. It was, of course, you know, mom saw the value in other kids going to the school, wanted to do this, but didn't want to give up her law practice. I understand that. A five-day school is their better option then. Right? That's what I was really trying to say. But I guess we make enemies. Another thing that we see, and all of you have seen if you've been in this business for a while, is the family that has maybe three kids, and the first one's really high achieving, and the second one isn't so high achieving, but then by the time we get to the third, they don't care about their grades at all. I mean, this is my family. I've got my daughter was, you know, type A. She would come back with the assignments given her in class, and she'd work all night to get them. She wouldn't get up and do them the next day. She'd do them that night. That's how type A she was. You know, so honestly, I hope she's not going to listen to this. There's very little chance she will. But I worry about the neurosis attached with the type A child with my daughter. My son was a different lower type on the lettering scheme. He loved getting, he called them B vitamins. If I got a B in that class, it's good. That's fine. That shows that I've got a balanced life. My other son seems to be interested in vitamins D and E, and not even C for that matter. So it is something that you see all the time in a family, is that the sibling may not be suited to the school that they've fallen in love with as the older children. That's magnified in a university model school. As the children are younger, the parents can lead them back to the table in the second grade to do their math. By the time they're in ninth or 10th grade, there's no doing that. if they are not interested in doing, if they have not picked up that stick by the time they're young adults, it's one of the saddest things to watch. And parents begin to realize that the motivational aspect of this is really important. How do you motivate someone to study, you know, at 8 o'clock the next morning when they don't have to? And so that magnifies itself. I guess there's one other thing that I would say before I would open this up for questions, and that is, you know, that greatest strength is sometimes your greatest weakness. You know, one of the greatest strengths is that we get that high degree of parent involvement. When that works, we get a synergy there that really is phenomenal. One and one is more than two. But sometimes the high degree of parent involvement creates boundary issues for parents. And I say that politely, because who would blame a mother or father for wanting the best for their child? I will not. But the fact that we're a university model school doesn't mean that you think it would be better for your son to take the test on Thursday as opposed to the scheduled one on Tuesday. It's still a school. And for the sake of the servant of the Most High God, that is your teacher, they want to give it for the other 17 kids on Tuesday. We can't customize this for 18 individuals. And unfortunately, when you have highly involved parents, you have boundary issues like that that might make you laugh in any other school, but we encounter them a lot. This idea of, well, we're collaborative, aren't we? Yeah, but that doesn't mean that we have 17 individual curricula here. We have to follow the schedule. And that's difficult for us. It's also difficult when we want a specialized learning situation. You know, my son has a little dyslexia. Do you think the teacher could read the exam to them and then he could just, you know, verbally recount the answers to her? And I have to say, no. I understand why you want to do that. I understand it, but I'm not equipped to do that. I'm certainly not going to ask that teacher to do that. And believe it or not, that's created division between long-standing, wonderful Christian families and me. Because you're just going to turn down them. I'm like, yes, I am. So you understand there's a high degree of expectation that comes with highly involved parents, and maybe that's all I need to say about that. I'm getting enough heads nodding that maybe you know. So let me conclude by telling you that I firmly believe parents are the primary educators of their children. The university model schools, or the university model type schools, attempt to leverage that. There are obvious advantages, and for certain families, those advantages are through the roof. But it comes with some obvious limitations and challenges. In the end, we found at Coram Deo Academy that it's worth pursuing. For those cases where the one and the one adds up to more than two, that synergy, we still do that. In the back here is my development director. Donnie, will you just wave your hand? This is Dr. Donnie Brake, the development director of the school. He has a ministry in the Sudan that he also is in charge of. And the Sudanese Christians have a proverb that if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, you go together. And when we are able to partner with parents and bring them together along the journey, they learn more about classical education, they're more constantly involved in their children's education, and when it works, it's absolutely beautiful. We go farther together. Thank you for your time. Let me open this up now to any questions or observations. That we got a small enough group. Yes. It's a great question, and it just for the sake of whatever recording, the question is, how do we take 5-day-a-week curriculum and cram it into a 2-day-a-week model? We almost have to customize everything. But if you will look at a phonics lesson, sometimes we distribute them over 2 years. So we might buy a set of things that we can do over a couple of years. We have an algebra book that's a really very feature-rich. Parents can help with it. And we've decided to make that 7th and 8th grade because of that. That helps us divide up the lessons. But it's a challenge. You don't always do it well. Most of our history and literature classes are believe it or not, are able to do it a little bit easier. So we will do 5 books instead of 10 that you might do because of that. And, you know, the English teachers are always pressing me, but couldn't we just add one more? And our summer reading list keeps growing because of that. But one of the things that you have to do is work very carefully with them. I mean, this, one of the hardest things about that customization is that you have to get your teachers to buy into it, because no teacher wants to cut anything. But you know, I think you have to begin with the attitude that to some of these things, less is more. So a second grade math book that has 150 standards that the kids want to learn, I'm just going to tell you something. That's ridiculous, right? Moses brought down 10, right? So I really do believe that you could get with your math people and figure out, what are the top 64 lessons we want to enforce? And frankly, do we really want second graders to you know, have mastery of maybe just 10 concepts or 20? And when you approach it that way, from a more of a less is more, I'm going to go deeper into fewer topics, it helps you do that. But you still have to do some customization in almost every curriculum. That's what we found. We have not had any problem with that. And in some cases, if you notice, and I can speak much more to this authoritatively as a math person, sometimes we introduce fractions 9 times to kids through a sequence of math. Well, we're going to introduce it only 4 times to them, and it's still, because of the fact that we're going to focus on it, it works. So we've not found a problem with college readiness, because the standards that are measured for that are fewer than those that appear in your book. But what we have found is that when we start cutting up a textbook, that we do occasionally cut something out of second grade that, oh, we need to add back. Because so there's your point is well made. We you know, when we cut something out of a sequence, we have to be really careful. And we sometimes find we've made that mistake only into it. But I do think it's doable. There's an awful lot of repetition in those. So behind you there, yes. No, we're not requiring them to do that. Occasionally, a mom. If you're committed to going through all the lessons in a book, yes. All right? And I'm not trying to be defensive, but I'm saying if we were to take a look at our geometry books and figure out what we really wanted kids to learn, you know, from when it comes to proofs, what things are really important for them to know from that book, I would be able to probably condense that down to where we wouldn't have to teach 2 lessons every day. And some of the lessons will naturally fit together well. So again, it isn't perfect. I don't want to be overly defensive about it, but there are ways to accommodate that. But you must begin with the idea that you know, starting at the beginning of the textbook and teaching every lesson sequentially through it, we're going to have to be open to the idea that we might not do that in this model. Let me go over here, yeah. Yeah. So there are some lessons that you can pick that, hey, learn this on your own. You're learning how to learn. This is an easy enough lesson. You should learn this at home with the video. This is a different lesson. I want to illustrate this to you in class. So you can apply that to it. But there really is no way to get around that you have 150 lessons to get into a 65 lesson bag. How's that? Yeah. Right. Over here. I think we'll have time for everybody's questions, so please. We have 3 campuses. We own 2 of those, the ones in Flower Mound, the one in Plano. We still rent space in our Dallas school, which is the youngest and the smallest. So the tuition is lower than our competition, almost by half. Not quite. I'd say it's about 60% of comparable 5-day-a-week schools. Okay? That's right. Yeah. Over here. Well, that's a really good question. The question was, are the majority families drawn by the collaborative, you know, university model schedule or classical education? Dr. Brake and I would probably tell you that most of them are drawn by that the model. It's a continuous process of education to enlighten everyone to the virtues of classical education. And I include myself in that, and I would assume everyone in this room has found that the more we study it, the more we realize we didn't know it and maybe we thought we did. So we, rather than having a boot camp and you read these two books and now you know about classical education, and by the way, I'm not opposed to boot camps. They're great. But I think we need to consider the classical education as more of a discipleship that we're taking them through over a period of, you know, at least 10 years. So it is, you're right, people come to us more because of our, the what we call our collaborative model, and they may not even care about classical education. That's no different than me. When I started at Coram Deo Care, I didn't care that it was a classical school. It fit my schedule. So I have grown to love it over the years, and I think that's what we try and do with our parents. But it is a challenge, and it, for us, it has to be continuous. So that's a good, really good observation. Back there. It kind of depends. The question is, what happens when a family brings in a tutor to help? I think a struggling student in chemistry, right, that is otherwise succeeding in other classes, and there just is not enough seat time for them to get chemistry, a tutor outside that teaches them chemistry and gets them over that one hump is something that we would not be in any way opposed to. If a student needed continuous tutoring in all the subjects because of this, then they're just in the wrong model. Does that address what you're talking about? So we wouldn't be opposed to somebody getting help in a class because the schedule didn't fit them in that particular subject, and we've seen that work successfully. As a matter of fact, that's probably a good lesson to learn when you go to college, is to know which classes you need help in and how and where you go to get your own help for that. We try and keep a track of it, because if you have to have a tutor for every one of your classes, then you're probably in the wrong school environment. Does that answer your question? Thank you. It's a good one. Up here, you've been waiting patiently.
One question that we have is we're going to add a logic school in the next few years. So do you have formal logic that we can teach?
Yes. Yes, and we've had to customize that curriculum, but yes, we teach formal logic. We've chosen to teach it in the ninth grade rather than some of the people teach it seventh and eighth. It's the cap of the logic school, and that's fine. We've chosen to teach it in the ninth grade. We find that the maturity of the students sometimes helps with our choice to teach it in a particular time. So like Algebra 2, we teach in the 10th grade because that's one of those difficult classes to go back and forth, and the more mature students, the 10th graders, are a little bit more likely to pick up that at home and do their part there. So we do teach formal logic. No, we really don't. But I will tell you this, one of the hardest things for us over 17 years has been figuring out how to balance the class load. But I'll be honest with you. I'm going to get in trouble for this. That's usually a teacher problem. That's usually we've got somebody who's so in love with their subject that I understand that you're taking five other classes, but let's be honest, math is the most important thing. And if you don't do it, you're going to be, you know, delivering pizzas. So I'm going to teach you more math than these other people. And sometimes it's not so consciously insulting as that. But that's the attitude that a lot of our teachers have. They're in love with their subject. It is, to them, the most important. So students will tell us that they go through the school day and there's 55 minutes with an insane person who believes that what they're teaching is the most important thing and all of them can't be right, right? So it usually begins with the teachers having more of a holistic understanding of what we need to do in every class, and that helps. That helps before we start doing the less is more exercises on any other curriculum as well. Yes, go ahead. That's right. Yeah, from a population control standpoint, right? It is optional for the younger students. So our K through 8 are not required to take any classes on Friday. And we lengthen the periods on Friday. Instead of doing 6 55 minutes, we do 4 90-minute periods. And, you know, a laboratory science would be required. If you're going to take biology, then you're going to take it on Monday, Wednesday, and you're going to be there for a 90-minute lab on Friday. Also, there are certain electives, you know, drama, where we need to get critical mass of students that are to participate, so we will hold that on Friday. Friday has actually become challenging from a scheduling standpoint for us because of those. That's when all the elective classes, you know, come. And but it's not, you know, I think I told you that there's about 375 students that attend on any given day. That population on Friday is closer to 400 because of that overlap. So it is higher, but it's not radically higher because of the fact that it's still optional for a lot of the students. All the way in the back. Yeah, I wish I could show you our presentation. Because it's so hard to tell someone this 2-day model isn't fitting your child, we are really open in all of our literature and all of our presentations about that. And the hardest part, though, that we can be as open as we want about is that sometimes the child grows out of that. So a child that succeeded in this model in kindergarten through sixth grade gets to seventh grade, the teenage rebellion kicks in, and now mom and dad can't make them work the hours at home. I mean, they can lock them in their room and take everything away from them, but they're still, the motivation isn't there to do that work on their own. So we're as upfront as we can be about the fact that this might be a problem for you in the future, that this happens all the time. There's no apology necessary. It sometimes is a better fit to be in a 5-day school, but sometimes it sneaks up on a family in a way that it's hard to prepare them for. Does that answer your question? And will you tell us again about the gathering? There's at 5:15 today? And your school is? Okay, and Grace Classical, Jackson, North Carolina, is hosting a gathering at 5:15. Do you know where that will be? I just... Three Rivers Lounge, okay. Well, that's perfect place to relax. Yes, before the band gets in there. So, right in front there, yeah. Well, that's not entirely true. For high school students, we offer a split schedule that allows them to take 3 classes on Monday, 3 classes on Tuesday, and then they live in the study center the whole time. That costs more. Less than 5% of our students want that. But once we get to the high school level, we do offer that option for some students. Well, I'm probably not as able to speak to that because we've always been university model K through 12. But I do know other schools that have gone from a 5-day to a university model. And they came to visit us, and their entire board flew into Dallas and met with us to learn about how to do it. And they made a decision to close the whole school and completely reopen to give everybody a chance to maybe go somewhere else, to relaunch it that way. But they did the whole school that way, too. There are certain advantages to doing this at younger grades. You know, for me, it's interesting. I think there's somebody that's thinking about doing this in their older grades. I see it as a huge benefit in the younger grades, and the time when I see it begin to be a problem is when we hit those teenage years, and it would really be helpful to have a 5-day option. And that's why we introduced one, but the cost, most people try and do that at home. If you're going to just be in a study center doing your homework, come home, it'll save us a few $1,000s a year. And I understand that, but that's so. I don't think I answered your question, but I. Yeah, and if I were in that position to consider it, I would consider it easier to implement at the younger grades. I think that was what I wanted to say. And next to you there was a question. I can't comment other than I might agree with that. And I don't know is there a school represented in this room that has that is a university model type school in the early grades and then a full-time, you know, is that what you do? I'm glad I never had any of those issues at all. And this is Veritas in Austin. And how long have you been operating under that schedule? And so would you suggest that that's been successful? Or yeah, probably eliminate a lot of the hardships that we see. So. The leaving and cleaving does seem to be biblical, so I won't, I mean, so that's an interesting option. Over there, sir, yeah? Yeah. Well, one of the things that teaching in this model, I fell in love with it. So I started on Tuesday, Thursday, became full-time within 3 years because I wanted to be there more, and the school was growing. And so what we find is that if we were to engage someone to teach a class on Monday and Wednesday, it's a minimal investment on their part and our part. We get to observe them in the classroom. And if they really are gifted as a teacher, they know, right? The reward comes to them in ways that we are able to expand because, you know, as the school has grown, we've been able to offer more to those teachers that are part-time, that are becoming full-time. We're certainly able to increase their hours a little bit year by year. So that's, in our school, we have about a 90% retention rate among faculty. The 10% who leave are just leaving for normal reasons in a larger metropolitan area. The spouse's job is moving or whatever. So for those openings, the first place we look are our part-time teachers that have demonstrated that they are indeed Ephesians 4 gifted, and we give them options to teach more, and that's usually how we fill out those positions. Is that... Yeah. That's true. I mean, it's still we have about 200 faculty and administration. I think only 40 are full time. So I would assume that that ratio is probably something that you would see even at a smaller level. So in some cases, people like that part time. Someone that wants full time, that's a challenge, I think, for all of us. How do we take somebody that's really a good fit? They do phenomenal work with students in the classroom. There's obvious Christian discipleship. This is going to be somebody's favorite teacher that they remember for life, and we can't offer them a full-time job, and they need that. That has happened to us before. But I honestly don't know that that is escapable in any other model as well. I'm not sure that's unique to our model. Does that make sense? I think I see where you're going. It's really difficult to attract somebody that's a full-time teacher in a public school or in another environment to come just teach 2 days a week because of all the obvious cuts in salary, et cetera. So that is a huge challenge for us. Occasionally, we're confident enough of their ability through observation and reputation that we would consider hiring them full-time, and we're able to make that, but that's pretty rare. So that is a problem. Sir? I actually think the government sets that threshold at some percentage of a full-time, a full-time 40-hour work week, approximately then 2,080 working hours in a year. So we actually try to accord it by hour. So if you're teaching this class, we think that consumes this many hours of your time, an hour in class, probably 2 hours out for grading and prep. We want to try and account for that as much as possible. And so for us, the threshold is something, I think it's about, once you achieve 75% or above, then you're required, I believe, by law to offer full-time benefits, et cetera. And if you're going to do that, then it really makes sense to fill out their dance card with everything else. So there's enough jobs to do around the school that's. So I think for us, it's around 1,500 hours would be the approximate. Yes, it would. At some point when you're teaching a certain number of classes, then that would account for you working 3/4 of full time, which means we might as well go ahead and see if we can fill out something where, you're an assistant coach over here, you're going to work in our study center here, you're going to do car line here. And those are all jobs that need to be done as the school gets bigger, so that isn't terribly hard to do. That make sense? I hope that answers the question. It's a puzzle every year that the principals on each of our campus go through, and I try and help them with it, but I'm really glad they're doing it because I did it for 4 years as the principal of our upper school. You know, it's just like a big Jenga board to try and see if I can fit everybody's schedule together. But, God always provides. So, yes. No, we really don't. We're a single track through 10th grade. 11th grade, we offer AP chemistry and then an AP environmental science. So there are different tracks in the 11th and 12th grades. Listen, I think we're done. Thank you so much for coming. I'll stick around for questions. God bless you in your efforts as you consider this. Thank you.